Welcome to Healthcare Rounds, the podcast serving you the ins and outs of health policy and business topics, as well as our take on the rapidly evolving healthcare delivery ecosystem. I'm your host, John Marchica, CEO of Darwin Research Group and faculty associate at the W.P. Carey School of Business and the College of Health Solutions at Arizona State University. Welcome to Healthcare Rounds Season 3. I'm excited to kick off the new year with a terrific speaker, Dr. Robert Pearl. Named one of modern healthcare's 50 most influential physician leaders, Dr. Pearl is an advocate for the power of integrated, prepaid, technologically advanced, and physician-led healthcare delivery. He serves as a clinical professor of plastic surgery at Stanford University School of Medicine and is on the faculty of the Stanford Graduate School of Business, where he teaches courses on strategy and leadership and lectures on information technology and healthcare policy. Dr. Pearl is the author of Mistreated, Why We Think We're Getting Good Healthcare and Why We're Usually Wrong, a Washington Post bestseller that offers a roadmap for transforming American healthcare. He hosts the popular podcast Fixing Healthcare, publishes a newsletter with over 10,000 subscribers called Monthly Musings on American Healthcare, and he's a regular contributor to Forbes. He has published more than 100 articles in medical journals and has contributed to numerous books. Board certified in plastic and reconstructive surgery, Pearl received his medical degree from the Yale University School of Medicine, followed by a residency in plastic and reconstructive surgery at Stanford University. Dr. Pearl, by the magic of podcast editing, by now I will have read in your bio, so people will have a sense of who you are. But in your words, just tell me a little bit about your background before we dive into it.
I went to medical school at Yale and then to Stanford for my residency in plastic and reconstructive surgery. My interest was children with cleft lip and cleft palate. I was an active surgeon for a couple of decades and then ultimately became the CEO of the Permanente Medical Group, the largest medical group in the country and responsible for the healthcare of over 5 million Kaiser Permanente members, both on the West and East Coast. In 2017, I wrote a Washington Post bestseller, Mistreated, Why We Think We're Getting Good Healthcare and Why We're Usually Wrong. All of the profits from the book go to Doctors Without Borders, a charity that provides relief work around the globe. And since then, I've been very involved in my own podcast, in writing my next book, Forbes articles, and any listeners who are interested in knowing more can find information on my homepage, robertpearlmd.com.
Excellent, excellent. And I'm not done with your book yet. I promised that I'd try to read it before our interview. Of course, life gets in the way, but it's an outstanding read, and I highly recommend it to anyone who's interested in the state of healthcare today, not just people in the business, but any consumers as well.
It's written, John, for all of the readers, because it's why it's called Mistreated, Why We Think We're Getting Good Healthcare While We're Usually Wrong. And that affects every one of us, both the patients who are physicians and those who are not clinicians.
Yeah, that's clear. So I'm going to ask you the big question first, and then maybe we can dive into some details. But there's one thing, and I know you've talked a lot about this, you've written a lot about this, but if you had to fix one thing in healthcare today, what would you tackle first?
The one thing that must get fixed for everything else to work is the growing unaffordability of healthcare coverage, and particularly the out-of-pocket payments that individuals have to make. The mistake that some have embraced is a belief that the challenge is healthcare coverage, whether it is provided by businesses, through the government, through Medicare for all, through individuals. It doesn't matter. If the cost of healthcare continues to grow at 5 to 6%, and if the ability of our nation to pay, whether you want to look at gross domestic product, whether you want to look at overall inflation, whether you look at overall wages, is only going up half to a third, maybe 2% or 3% at most, then regardless of who pays, it will become unaffordable and it will erode, regardless of how it is provided. What we will see is that it will end up being rationed. We'll see quality going down, delays happening, inconvenience growing. If we can't address the increasing unaffordability of healthcare, everything else we're going to talk about today will fail.
So I think if I've watched a couple of the Democratic debates, I think what they would say to that is, it's Medicare for all. Now you say, no, that's not the issue or that's not the answer. Why is that? So what's behind all of this in your view?
So in addition to teaching in the Stanford Medical School, I also teach in the Stanford Graduate School of Business. And one of the key points I make in the course I teach on strategy is that you always need to look at the second and third order consequences of any decision you make as an individual, as a business, or as a nation. Today, Medicare only pays 90 cents of the cost of actually delivering the care, and the remainder is made up by businesses and individuals who pay between 120 and 130%. As soon as you move to a Medicare for all system, the next question, the one that many candidates continue to duck, is how much are you going to pay? Because if you pay it 90%, the economics works, but half of the hospitals simply go out of business because the hospital industry is a 5% margin business. And if you cut your reimbursement by 10%, they end up in bankruptcy. The alternative is, okay, we're going to raise what the government pays. And now you have added costs. And added costs transitionally can be paid by deficit funding, but ultimately it has to be paid either through higher taxes, fewer services, restrictions in care, and those are the second and third order consequences that no one wants to talk about. It sounds great, Medicare for all. It sounds reasonable when you look at how much Medicare pays today, but it's the missing pieces of the equation, John, that people are avoiding and that the public needs to understand.
So let's peel that back another layer. Initially, you asserted some very powerful math. If healthcare costs are going up at 5-6% a year and everybody else, say, wage index or CPI is going up at 2-3% a year, you're going to eventually run into a really big problem. So what are some of the things that you've talked about, some of the ways that we can rein in those costs, get those costs in line without having quality suffer?
The focus to get the cost of healthcare down has to begin with the delivery system. I spoke to the CEOs of the major businesses earlier this year, and I asked them, how many of you have remodeled your kitchen or your bathroom or your house in some way in the recent years? And of course, many, many hands went up. I then asked them, how many of you simply paid your contractor whatever he or she wanted to do and paid them on a time and materials basis? And all the hands came crashing down. And I asked them, why would you assume, in fact, they all laughed, why would you assume it's impossible to give a contractor that degree of freedom? And yet that's what we do in medicine, and we somehow don't recognize that the fee-for-service world that simply reimburses volume rather than reimbursing quality, outcomes, life longevity, the kind of things that really matter, is going to raise prices without increasing or improving results. The first thing that has to change is we have to move from fee-for-service to capitation. For listeners who may not know what capitation is, it means you're prepaying for the care that's going to be provided the same way that you might if you're going to a all-inclusive resort. The total cost is now paid, and now the care is going to be provided in a way that aligns the needs and desires of patients with that of the providers, the doctors, and the hospitals. Why would patients not want to avoid disease in a decapitated system? Preventing a heart attack, preventing a stroke is the best way to go. Why would patients not want to avoid a medical error in a capitated system? The best way to lower cost is to avoid medical errors. For again, for the listeners who are not in the healthcare world, if a doctor makes a medical mistake, often they're paid twice, once for the mistake and once to improve it. The incentives don't align to maximize patient safety. If doctors are paid 50 or 100 times more to unblock the coronary arteries of a patient who's had a heart attack, rather than avoiding them becoming blocked in the first place, how much energy are they going to put into the preventive services? And what we know from a study coming out of the Mayo Clinic, based upon the New England Journal of Medicine published articles, 30% of what doctors do today add no value in a capitated system. Why would you do things that add no value? You're going to use those resources so much better to do the things that will help patients over time. As I say, I often stress these areas of how do you prevent disease in the first place? How do you avoid complications from patients who have a chronic illness, which is 30% of the American populace today? And then finally, how do you avoid these medical errors? I began the book Mistreated, Why We Think We're Getting Good Healthcare, Why We're Usually Wrong, with the story of my dad, who died from a medical error, not because his doctors didn't know what should happen. There just was not enough incentive to look at the opportunities to change the outcome of their actions rather than raising the volume, generating the added dollars from doing more things to provide acute care rather than future care.
So Dr. Pearl, my experience early on in my career in studying healthcare and the business side was that in the 90s, that capitation was something in managed care that, at least my impression was that it largely failed, that the incentive was there to withhold from everything, to not see patients, to not do anything. And so patient quality suffered. Now, I'm sure your experience at Kaiser Permanente was not that, and I'm sure there are plenty of examples otherwise, but what makes what you're describing today different than what was going on in the late 80s, early 90s?
This is an essential point for listeners to understand because we often use the same word for different approaches. When the managed care of the early 1990s was actually led by the for-profit industry. They looked at how healthcare was provided and said, if we bring a business lens, we will be able to decrease the cost of care. And they put in place a set of pernicious actions. Remember, this is being done through the insurance part, through the business part of the healthcare system. They found ways to exclude patients with pre-existing conditions because those are the ones that would have the highest cost. They found ways to deny care, to focus on pre-authorization. The problem was that the prepayment, you can call it capitation, I'd rather think of it as the insurance prepayment, was done at the insurance company level. What I'm talking about is capitation at the delivery system level. I'm talking about a competition between systems, a set of doctors and hospitals, I'll say in quotes, competing with other doctors and hospitals, being evaluated with publicly available data on quality, patient satisfaction, and cost. Now you have the right incentives not to do less, but actually to do more. Because if you're capitated at the delivery system level and you don't do something in a timely fashion, what happens is that your costs go up significantly and you pay the price. The difference in the insurance world is when something is not done in a particular year, then you reap the benefit and the patient pays the price. So what I'm talking about is capitating at the level of doctors and hospitals, but it's not just the move from fee-for-service to capitation. I think there's three other things that are necessary, John. First, we have to find a way to integrate care. And by that, I mean both horizontally and vertically, using the business parlance, being able to find ways to have doctors collaborate together with greater specialization and added focus in each area of medical care, and better linkage between primary care and specialty care. What patients complain about a lot today is the fragmentation of their care, the lack of coordination. Everyone's focused on a very narrow piece, one doctor on the kidney, one on the lung, one on the heart, one on the blood. No one is taking an accountability for the overall health care provided. The third part is technology, modern technology. In the business school class that I teach, in the first session, I always say to the students, what do you think is the number one way that doctors communicate crucial patient information with each other? Now, it's the first class of the year. They can't be certain. They sort of look at me, and I tell them it's the fax machine. And you know what they say? What is a fax machine?
Right.
They can't imagine. People have a computer. They print out a piece of paper. They put it into a fax machine. It arrives in another office, and then someone has to put it into a computer. The fax machine was developed in 1843, and it's the way that physicians send the most vital information today. And then finally, I think leadership. And I often speak about physician leadership, and some people assume it's because I'm a physician. That's not the reason why I focus on physician leadership. It's that I understand physician behaviors. And what listeners have to understand, although I say a lot of negative things about healthcare delivery, the physicians are the most motivated, the most dedicated people I know. They spend their entire 20s training. They're available nights and weekends to come in and provide care to patients having emergencies. The last thing in the world that they would want to do is harm a patient. And some of the slowness to change is simply the fact that they are afraid. In medicine, we have a dictum, first do no harm.
Right.
And if something's been working, you don't want to change it. And to get that change to happen, it doesn't come from fiat above. It doesn't come from an insurance executive or a hospital administrator. It comes because a clinician that you respect, often one that's taking care of you and your family, steps forward and helps you understand why a new approach is better than the one in the past. The challenge is that physicians are not taught these skills, skills that are essential components of a business school experience. And we need to train physician leaders if we want to make the evolution happen before the disruption that I believe is inevitable occurs. And this is going to require investments. And I think we need to think about physician development, physician leadership training, the same way we think about capital. You don't build a hospital and expect to get all the money back in the first year that it's open. You amortize it over a decade or even longer. And so that's the way I think we need to think about physician education and the combination of what I call in Mistreated, the four pillars: care that's integrated, capitated, technologically enabled, and well-led, I think can make this change in the delivery system to flatten that curve, lower the curve, and be able to make healthcare once again affordable, higher quality care at a lower price.
So, gosh, I don't know which follow-up question I want to do first. One was a clarifying question around what you mean by horizontal and vertical integration of the care.
So when I was the CEO in Kaiser Permanente, we looked at departments and we asked, how can we increase quality? A great example to me is women undergoing hysterectomy. I don't know if you know, but a lot of the listeners know there's two ways to do that operation. A big, long abdominal incision, 3 days in the hospital and 6 months to be unable to lift anything heavier than a shoebox, or done through these little telescopes endoscopically. And in doing that, the patient goes home the same day and can be back playing tennis often in a week. The problem with the endoscopic approach is that it's more difficult. You're working through those little telescopes instead of a big open hole in the abdomen. I asked the chiefs of OBGYN at Kaiser Permanente, 90% of whom were women, what is the minimum number of operations that a physician would have to have done last year for you to allow him or her to do your surgery? Not who would you pick, but if someone said, I only did X, you'd say, I'm sorry, you can't do my surgery. And they all agreed. The minimum was somewhere between 30 and 50 a year, 3 to 4 a month. What would you say, John, if I told you that half of the operations done in the United States today are being done by physicians who do fewer than 10 a year? Horizontal integration is you take all the physicians, and some specialize in the operating room, some specialize in the delivery room, some specialize in complex office procedures. And in doing that, you get greater specialization and added volume in a more narrow area. That's what I mean by horizontal integration. The vertical integration is the connection between the primary care and the specialty care physician. A program I put in place called P-Consult at the time stood for phone consult, and then evolved into V-Consult for video and D-Consult for digital, allowed the primary care physician, when he or she was seeing a patient and felt that he or she needed added expertise. The rest of the world, a consult is sent. The patient's told to call the specialist office. The specialist office can schedule it at some time in the future. Instead, what we said is, why not connect the doctors right now? And you can do that in a vertically integrated medical group. And what do we find? 40% of the time overall, the problem could be solved immediately without the need for a follow-up visit. And even in another 20 or 30% of the time, it moved the process along because the appropriate diagnostic studies or other pieces could be done in advance of the specialty visit. A great example is a patient coming in with a rash whom the primary care physician isn't quite sure what it is, wants the patient to go to a dermatologist. Instead of sending a consult, and I don't know what it's like in where you live, but across this nation, dermatology consults can take 6 days, 6 weeks, or even 6 months. Within 6 minutes, a picture was sent to the dermatologist overseeing the telemedicine that day. The diagnosis was immediately returned. Treatment could be started. That is the power of vertical integration. It couldn't happen in the typical fragmented community setting today.
So, implications of what you're saying, can you actually envision getting this done in a model that's not like a Kaiser, which is a highly integrated system? For example, here in town, for those that don't know, I'm here in Phoenix. How does Dignity Health, which is now Common Spirit, second largest, or maybe the largest for-profit, at least one or two, a massive system like that that's not integrated to the degree that you're talking about, how do they get from here to there?
I think that the process of change is going to actually be driven by the large employers. You know, the most common question I get is around how disruption is going to happen in this nation. You know, in the business school, when I've studied over 100 industries, John, I can't find, maybe you can think of one, but I can't find an industry that is as inefficient and ineffectual as medicine is today that has not been disrupted. The auto industry, the steel industry, Borders Books, Kodak, Yellow Cab, I can list industry after industry after industry. It's the same process. And I think it's going to come from the major employers. And I think it could come in one of three ways. It could come through what today is called Haven, the linkage together of Amazon, Berkshire Hathaway, and JP Morgan Chase. It's interesting. They announced their approach to changing healthcare, appointing Atul Gawande as the head, as being a not-for-profit for their own employees. But I think any of you listeners who believe that it's going to stay a not-for-profit just for their employees probably also thinks that Amazon only sells books. No, this is going to be a major force. And what they will do is they will go into communities, they will select physicians, they will select hospitals, and they will exclude quite a number. The problem that Dignity, as an example, might have, I don't know, Phoenix as well as in other locations, is that it's hard to exclude physicians even when the volume is fewer than 10 a year, when you also have accountability for hospitals. Because you can't run your hospitals if a lot of the patients who are there today are no longer going to be there. And the truth is, we don't need the number of hospitals today if we put in place a high-performing system. The piece I wrote for Forbes this week was about how the American healthcare system today is similar to the farming industry of the past. What we know right now is that the farms have consolidated. The small farms have disappeared. If we maintain the old system, we'd be producing one-fifth as much food for the American populace and actually now for the world as occurs. That is American healthcare today. It is still a 19th century cottage industry in its structure, in its technology, and its reimbursement. The second way, by the way, it could come is just from all the large purchasers saying, 5 years from now, we're not going to contract with anyone who has not created an accountable care organization, who has not brought together physicians from multiple specialties in a hospital and being able to work together as a single entity with whom we can contract and work. You may already know that there's a business written up in the New York Times about a month ago in Wisconsin that offered to its employees $5,000 to go to Mexico to have their surgery done, and they sent a Mayo Clinic trained physician, major Mayo Clinic trained surgeon. This is not second-rate care. It's just lower cost care. So many of the things that I think you're implying is how difficult it would be need to be overcome. The third possibility, though, that I see as a disruptive force, and it's why I almost turned the question around, not from how can they do it, but how can they avoid doing it despite the price that has to be paid, comes from a surgeon I know, Dr. Devi Shetty. And Dr. Shetty owns 11 heart hospitals in India. He, by the way, was Mother Teresa's physician. He's a very famous individual, trained in England and the United States. And in his heart hospitals, he does heart surgery for $1,800 a procedure, as opposed to over $100,000 in the United States. And his results, by the way, are in the top 10% of the American healthcare system. If Dr. Shetty were on the line, you said, Devi, what do you do? He would say, I set the price for a human life. And you'd say, what do you mean you set the price for a human life? I just spoke to Dr. Pearl. He fixes kids with cleft lip and cleft palate. And Dr. Shetty would say, every morning I show up at the hospital and there's 30 moms with 30 babies. They've all been well evaluated. They all need surgery. I do a lot of free surgery. I can't do it all for free. So I explained if they can borrow the money, because only 10% of people in India have insurance, I'll do the surgery, $1,800. If they can't, they take the baby home to die. If I get the cost down to $1,500 or $1,200, I will have elevated the price of a human life. Now, why I explain that is I don't think that Americans are going to travel to India. But people from Phoenix might travel to the Grand Cayman Islands, where Dr. Shetty's building on an island of 50,000 people, a 2,000-bed hospital. 50 of those beds are for the people of the Grand Caymans. 1,950 are going to be for people in Phoenix and people from Florida. That opportunity to make those change happen, to select the right number of physicians, to make sure that they have enough volume to provide the best care, to shrink the number of hospitals, to find ways to create centers of excellence. You know, I live part of the time in California and Silicon Valley. Between San Jose and San Francisco, there are 10 hospitals doing heart surgery. Three of them do fewer than 300 cases a year. That means mathematically at least 65 days of the year. They're paying a team to be there because they need a team on call with nothing to do. Tell me another industry that would pay people to be available at least 65 days a year and not have anything to do. Every first-year medical MBA student says, put the three hospitals together. Now you have enough volume, not just for greater efficiency and lower cost, but significantly higher quality. And the American healthcare system today, any hospital CEO who tried to close their cardiovascular service, knowing there was another one a short distance away so that patients would get actually better care, not worse care, would lose his or her job. My answer to you when it comes to the program in Phoenix or any of the programs is that today not changing is seen as better because the consequences of changing will be negative, not for the patients, better for the patients, but negative for the what I would call the legacy players, the hospitals, the insurance companies, the drug industry, the medical subspecialty professions, etc.
Wow, sure, sure. So I've got one final question. And it used to be a signature question when I'd have physicians on. I've kind of gotten away from it. But in particular, I'd like to hear your perspective. And that is, if you were talking to a young graduate of a medical school today, I'm sure you talk to a lot of them, what advice would you give that young doctor?
I do talk to a lot of physicians. I have a monthly musings that has over 10,000 subscribers. It's a monthly publication that has information and quite a number of the people who subscribe to it. By the way, there's no expense and there's no advertising. Quite a number of people are in medical school and residency, and they do want to know the answer to these types of questions. The first thing I would do is congratulate them. I would tell them that medicine is the greatest profession. There is no other place where people can go to work every day with the intent of making the lives of others better. I would explain to them that the culture of medicine often gets in the way. Culture is handed down from past generations, and they will be handed that same culture, and they need to be looking at that culture. I'd warn them that today 40% of physicians report symptoms of burnout, fatigue, dissatisfaction, lack of fulfillment, sense of helplessness, sense of being a victim. And I would tell them they have to look for the ways to avoid following in the path of others. And that's going to require that they understand purpose. I would explain that healthcare is becoming more unaffordable, that half of the families in the United States today can't make the out-of-pocket payments required should they get a significant illness without borrowing money, and that the problem across their career is going to become even worse, and that they should come together, that they should understand that some of being a physician is making care available to others, to understand their plight. And their plight right now is very much about the economics. And that many of the things that they will learn in their training, they've got to understand the second and third order consequences of that. The fact that 30% of what doctors do today adds no value, and yet they continue to do it. That patients, as an example, the most commonly done surgery in orthopedics for knee pain is arthroscopy with cartilage trimming. It's been shown to be no better than physical therapy alone, yet doctors keep doing it. And that they're going to have to find the way with their colleagues to change that culture, that we think it's going to make us happier to simply do more and more and more. And the data says that it doesn't. The data says actually it's making us less happy. It's accounting for this factor of burnout. It's leading in some cases to more than one physician's suicide a day. I would in the end tell them, first of all, to read the book. But more than that, what I would tell them is that they need to address the four pillars. They need to come together with colleagues, equally motivated, mission and purpose driven, and create both horizontal and vertical integration. They've got to find ways with their colleagues to make care higher quality at lower cost, to focus on prevention, avoidance of complications, avoidance of medical errors. And in doing that, they've got to embrace technology. They've got to embrace the electronic health record, as clunky and problematic as it is today. Find ways to use video to make care more convenient to patients so that they don't have to miss work and school to come to the doctor's office. Find ways to use data analytics and artificial intelligence to reduce the cost of healthcare provided to patients. That they've got to find the ways to lead the process of change, that others are not going to do it, or if they do it, they're not going to do it in the ways that are best for patients. And in the end, I think that they've got to embrace a tradition that goes back five millennia, a tradition of recognizing the privilege of providing medical care to people. And I will assure them that when they do that, when they re-embrace the sense of mission and purpose, that they will find tremendous satisfaction and never regret the choice that they made.
Well, that's some advice. That's amazing. Listen, Dr. Robert Pearl, I appreciate your time. This is fantastic getting your views. Our listeners are definitely in for a treat. A reminder again, your book is called Mistreated, Why We Think We're Getting Good Healthcare and Why We're Usually Wrong. And remind me again, your website where they can find more about you.
The best place is robertpearlmd.com. There they can find all of the past musings. They can find a variety of other articles, links to my podcast, links to your podcast, links to all the different places they can get medical information. I would encourage them not just to go themselves, but to tell others, because I do believe that the more people who get involved in the conversation, the more people involved in the debate, the more diverse the audience, the better the solutions are going to be. I always end my podcast by saying, together, we can make American healthcare once again the best in the world. I believe it then, and I appreciate the work that you're doing to reach that destination. Thank you, John.
And thank you. That's all for this week. From all of us at Darwin Research Group, thanks for listening. If you haven't yet done so, please rate and review Healthcare Rounds wherever you listen to podcasts. Healthcare Rounds is produced by Diana Nikolic and engineered by Andrew Rojek. Theme music by John Marchica. Darwin Research Group provides advanced market intelligence and in-depth customer insights to healthcare executives. Our strategic focus is on healthcare delivery systems and the global shift toward value-based care. To learn more about us, go to darwinresearch.com or send an email to insights@darwinresearch.com. Or if you'd like to get right to it, call us at 888-402-3465. See you next round.